I'd like to invite Kate Colby up to introduce C.A. Conrad.
Hello. Thank you all for being here tonight. I am so happy to have C.A. Conrad here. I've been reading and following his work for a long time, but I'd never met him, never met the person until today. And this is just a little something I wrote about his work. When I was a kid, I was always hurling rocks at the ground looking for geodes. Now you can buy bags of them at toy stores. They come with a little hammer. My six-year-old son was recently introduced to these in a science lesson at school. Not only can't I see the fun or the lesson in this activity, but it also depresses me. There are so many forms of ready-made sublimity in our world. Northern lights on YouTube, dramatic weather events replaced by their accu-anticipation. Ready-made sublimity is an oxymoron, of course. The sublime cannot be made or handed over. It's stumbled upon, as I always hoped I would a geode in the woods of Massachusetts, which is ridiculous. But every time I didn't, it felt like the earth had and got to keep more secrets. In one of his somatic exercises, C.A. Conrad describes meditating daily on a webcam broadcast of nesting hawks in his hometown of Philadelphia. At the time, he was on a residency in the Canadian Rockies. This daily return to where he came from is ridiculous, he says. But he also says, the ridiculous world's exertions is what I sought to unzip the sublime. Through rituals that serve to disarrange his brain and disarm others, Conrad induces a presence that stands in for everything, quote, registering disposition of cat in the dark as the size of the darkness. In the poems that attend his rituals, the ridiculous and the dire have equal weight. In one, a planet coping with 7 billion human breaths a second also accommodates this one person whacking the snow with a banana and chanting, this tropical fruit now knows the ice crystal. This tropical fruit now knows the ice crystal. Geode is Greek for earth-like, and Conrad's poems feel like mise-en-abîme worlds that keep their own secrets. The ritual and the poem don't match, but internest, contain and allow for one another. Their sublimity is active and perpetual. While they resist interpretation and any kind of static meaning, the poem's formal and, yes, crystalline beauty is a pure pleasure to read, hear, and behold. C.A. Conrad is the author of 8 books of poetry and essays. The latest, Ecodeviance, Somatics for the Future Wilderness from Wave Books, is the winner of the 2015 Believer Magazine Book Award. It's also on the desk in the back along with several of his other titles, and I encourage you after the reading to consider buying one. He's about to embark on a long cross-country journey, and maybe it'll help. He's a 2015 Headlands Art Fellow and has also received fellowships from Lannan Foundation, McDowell Colony, Banff, UCross, Radar, and the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. He conducts workshops on somatic poetry and ecopoetics. Please help me welcome C.A. Conrad.
Thank you, Kate. Should I put this down? Do you want this down? I don't know. I know it doesn't amplify, but I thought, you know, it's here. We should use it.
No, it's just for the podcast.
How's that? Thank you so much for having me. This has been such an amazing week so far. I love Gloucester. I've never spent this much time here. It's an incredible place. Well, I thought that I would start off by reading a little bit from this book called The Book of Frank. Mainly because Jonathan Williams, who was one of the last living Black Mountain poets, he was going to publish it. And then he passed away before it came out, and then Wave picked it up. But I'm excited about this book, especially considering that I come from this factory town where most of the people are, well, pretty much illiterate. and nobody had bookshelves where I grew up. And now I've got this book that's been translated into Spanish and German and Swedish and most recently Norwegian. And I'm very excited about that. I can't read any of those books, but I can read my English. So do you want to hear a little bit about editing this with Jonathan? Sure. So there are about 1,500 pages altogether. So there's, I don't know what's in here, roughly 150. So most of the poems nobody's ever seen, except for, well, obviously me and Jonathan Williams and his intern. So he was frustrated because I just kept writing them. They just kept coming. And he would sit with these giant stacks of poems while he would play a symphony with his scotch and a cigar. And he would play a favorite baseball game on VCR, but he'd mute the TV. And so this is all going on. And then in the fireplace, there was another video playing a burning building or something burning. Anyway, so it's just very interesting and strange to edit this way. And if he liked a poem, he would say, oh, this is nice. And he'd put it next to him on the couch. If he didn't like it, he would say, this is shit. And he would throw it over his shoulder. Then I would have to pick it up and argue with him, which I did. But we couldn't keep all 1,500 in there. So anyway, that was my editing process with Jonathan. And then we would go out on the porch and wait for his pet bat to wake up. Bruce the bat. Yeah. When Frank was born, Father inspected the small package the nurse handed him. But where's my daughter's cunt? My daughter has no cunt. Mother leaned from the bed. This is your awful son, dear. Your son has no cunt. Why doesn't my son have a cunt? What has happened? What a wicked world, dark and spitting on its one good leg. Okay, so I attribute this mostly incorrectly, but who cares, to George W. Bush's memoir, if you've read it. Where he would talk about his mother, Barbara Bush, showing him you know about this, right? She would show him a jar with a miscarried fetus and formaldehyde at breakfast. Not every morning, I guess, but, you know, enough for him to invade nations without cause. Frank hated the 9 miscarriages kept in jars of formaldehyde. Mother burped each one, spooned peas against the glass. She rocked them all at once in her arms, no room for Frank. You are too big for a jar, my child. You will betray me the rest of your life. Father was drunk and yelling, and rule number 9, everybody dies. Upon hearing rule number 9, Frank suddenly forgot all other rules. Frank grew crows for hands. It was a difficult childhood. At dinner during prayer, his crows flapped excited in the name of the Lord. Frank, keep still, mother hollered. Did you wash your crows? Did you wash your filthy, stinking crows? When father died, Frank was found straddling him, his crows picking the 7 gold fillings. I don't know. I don't often talk about these, but why I rate the certain ones that I did. But when I was a youngster in Philadelphia, I was shocked to find out that so many gay men were misogynists, scum. And I would get in these fights. You know, when you're a gay man and you're alone with other gay men, things get said that you have to confront. So anyway, this is for them. Afraid of the big giant vagina. Ridiculous. Frank saw a giant eat a park bench with her vagina, drink a swimming pool with her vagina. I saw her swallow the baby and spit out the crib, Frank said. He tiptoed past her snoring uterus one night and heard a few familiar voices cry out. Would you sign my book, Mr. Poe? Frank asked the pile of bones amid shovels of dirt. Why, certainly, young man, answers Frank in a different voice. This is your captain, Frank says from the cockpit. All passengers wishing to bail out any time during our flight, it is too late. I have shredded the parachutes to confetti in celebration of our arrival. Frank knows a butterfly who wonders about her old caterpillar friends. For love, Frank spoke softly into envelopes instead of writing letters. And this is, it says at the top for Jonathan Williams, this one, because I wrote this for him when he was in the hospital, just soon before he died, to cheer him up. Frank is grateful for the ride, but knows most trucks carry semen stains. Looking for these, the driver asks, pointing to eager swimmers long since dried on radio, ashtray, cup holder. May flowers. Frank shuts his legs, but music seeps through. At the party, everyone traced fingers on their bodies where they preferred to have cancer, if they had to have cancer. The host asked Frank where he'd like to have his. What a question, Frank said. I'd like my cancer right here, and traced a circle on the host instead. From the menu of dead authors, Frank orders Emily Dickinson's breast of dumplings and the braised thigh of an Isnin. His wife orders Leo Tolstoy's ring finger with caviar and the candied genitals of Jack Kerouac. Kerouac's erection arrives, shimmering in gravy. Mmm, she says, nibbling the tip. Frank glares and stabs a breast. At the doctor's request, Frank stops shaving the chair. In a month, it was the most comfortable chair in the house. Frank hands the cowboy a wad of tissues. These contain semen I produced when thinking of you. The cowboy sniffs them and smiles. Thanks, Frank. I'll put them with the others. Frank remembers shirts of buried generals flying in formation over schoolyards, blowing wasps from sleeves. Is no one else sick of this paralysis of gravity? Frank asks. When I was a boy, I stepped into the sky, and I was a boy, not a surrealist. Part of the dream is that you accept your waking life as part of the dream. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world. Frank says to Pig, this fence keeps you in your world. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world. Frank says to Pig, this fence keeps you in your world. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world. Don't worry, I'm not going to read all of those. Let's see. So this is a book of my rituals. I just want to read a couple of poems from the piece that Kate was talking about, that ritual. Reading Starlight with One Eye Like Creeley. It's kind of amazing. This came out in Poetry Magazine, and people who, I have no idea who they are, wrote me, a couple of people, not like a lot of people, but enough, A couple of people wrote me some angry emails about the title, that it was disrespectful. I was like, look, he had one eye, and that's how he would look at Starlight, because he only had one eye. So I closed an eye to see what it would be like. I think it's actually kind of lovely. They didn't write back after that, but, you know, I just wanted to write back. Reading Starlight with one eye like Creeley. Hearing all bells at once instructs the final exhale. Camelot and thimble of the gods. Marilyn Monroe's ambulance lost on the way to the Palace of Temperament. A branch of government for the magical arts. Punch wall of farce for an oaken desk. Another dream we needed, agitating the sentence as it rose across a newly destroyed heart. Folding, following, tormenting one another. We were all once young and beautiful, squandering everything. It's what we came here to do. Cut off engines to the child. Registering disposition of cat in the dark as the size of the darkness. So one of the things that I get asked sometimes when I'm visiting schools from students is if, I was talking about this earlier with Kate, sometimes they ask, about depression and poetry, do you need to be miserable to write? And I always say that no. I mean, I wouldn't be doing it if that were the case. I actually think the opposite is true. I think that you can completely cure yourself of depression with poetry. And I want to read a few pieces where I did that. Yeah, I had a boyfriend who was brutally tortured and raped and murdered in Tennessee, and as though that wasn't bad enough, then the police, I had to deal with the police, and the police were very, well, the sheriff called me faggot every other sentence on the phone, for instance, just like a really horrendous kind of situation. And there's this documentary that's just come out about my life. It's kind of changed my life dramatically in the sense that I owe them the fact that they believed me. That because the police wrote up his death as a suicide, which is ridiculous. He was bound and gagged. I mean, and there were no empty containers on site. It was at this place called Short Mountain in Ida, down in Tennessee, this queer community. But anyway, I was convinced that I could do rituals for making poetry that would alleviate the sadness. So I wound up doing three of them. One of them's in my book, A Beautiful Marsupial Afternoon, and then there's one that I did in this latest book, Ecodeviance. But they were, while I enjoyed the poems that I got out of those, it didn't really work. Then I did this one. It's called Mount Monadnock Transmission. And the last time I saw him alive, he gave me a crystal that I took with me to McDowell Colony. And I also ate another crystal every day. And I would, shit it out and then sterilize it and eat it again. That was kind of fun. But working with the one that he gave me completely obliterated all that sadness and this horrible movie that had been playing in my head about the killers being caught. There's a courtroom drama. All that's vanished and it's not returned. So I'm going to read some of those poems. The poems are titled, it's all one title for the group of poems, Sharking of the Birdcage. I don't know if you're familiar with that slang term, sharking. It's, from what I understand, it's from Japan. I'm not exactly sure about this. Something about like ripping women's clothing off in public. It's this horrible thing. And I just kind of felt, when I first heard that definition, I was like, oh, God, I should have. Part of me feels like that happened to him. And it also, like, happens to me over and over again when I have to deal with the police. Never fun to deal with them. A beautiful moving target is all you wanted to be, aspiring future wilderness. You must know by now that our quiver, my wan genius, shot back through same hole. Not everything allows for indulgence analogous to be opened by morning. Fall forward, fall conjuring. Tell the farmer we cannot taste as milk, but wish to. A finger in the web to give it back tenfold. Holding our gorged fragment as promise to change if we want change. Another evening to falter under the chrysalis. A wayward protein bloodletting from unforeseen orifice gathers us to elongated grass-fed hours, falling victim to the song in its silken casing. Too urgent for punctuation, coping with an inferior century foaming over the rim. A smile hanging on the face was as though it will pay off, but then it does pay off. We didn't think we could open up like this. Here we are, living in the better place to know. The mountain throat temple is our uncontrollable humming from meditating on Mount Monadnock. Paint over the dead-end sign. Are police writers? Yes. They are writing into books our little cherub of misunderstanding. A thinking to push us back into body of the whole. Love yourself more next time, their reports read. Stones sink as they please, a lit cigarette into our dark hello. What was it you wanted us to say after you died? It's awful without you making sound exist. You said, ponder this, but none of us can remember. What now, dear? Please speak up. When quaking became zeal to open, nothing now but a medieval barking gargoyle. Whoever gave you the tambourine shall be sheriff of my tender zoo. I am not here. I am in the future, where I've always been. Please hurry back and forth to kiss me, my ghost. So I thought it would be, I'm going to read a couple from the book Ecodeviance. In this case, I'm going to actually read the rituals first, okay? So the first one in the book, never mind, I'm just going to read the ritual. I'm going to read the ritual and then the resulting poem. The ritual is titled MIA Escalator for Jen Benka and Carol Mirakov. I rode several of my favorite escalators in Philadelphia, taking notes up and down the vantages. At the top and bottom of the ride, I would show photographs of myself to strangers and ask, "Excuse me, have you seen this person?" Sometimes there was confusion. "Isn't that you?" I'd reply, "No. Many people think I look like her, but have you seen her?" I feel very fortunate to have been born before the ultrasound machine. My generation was the last generation to have a male and female name waiting at the other end of the birth canal. My generation is the last to have our mothers touch their bellies, talking to us as male and female, pink or blue, both pink and blue. Have you seen this person? I enjoyed my conversations with strangers and made at least one new friend. I am a handsome man who knew I was the person in the photograph. That person, I am that person and agreed. The ultrasound machine gives the parents the ability to talk to the unborn by their gender, taking the intersex 9-month conversation away from the child. The opportunity is limitless in our new world. Encourage parents to allow anticipation on either end. Escalators are a nice ride, slowly rising and falling, riding while riding, notes for the poem, meeting new people at either end. Excuse me, my escalator notes became a poem. You're welcome. And I like this as an example because if you saw the poem separate from this, you wouldn't ever expect what I was doing to make it. The poem is titled, "I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead." I have a mannequin for a paperweight. It is difficult to type with such a large paperweight. I reach around a lover's late into night typing. From behind, it is impossible to tell which is Virgil. Poetry can be of use. The field of flying bullets the hand reaches through. Loving the aftertaste. Finding a deeper third taste. Many are haunted by human cruelty through the centuries. I am haunted by our actions since breakfast. You said too much poetry. I said too much war. The biggest mistake for love is straining. There was a door marked mistake we entered. You said too much fooling around. I said fuck off and die. I thought I'd read another one from this book. So I lived in Philadelphia from the early part of the mid part of the 80s till about 2013. So I saw the rise in surveillance and very angry about it. And we put up with it, you know. I feel like it's an extension of the working class paradigm, working in these factories. My family, they're all factory workers. They're treated like children. You know, they're constantly being treated like they're... Well, and that sums it up. They're treated like children, which is why they had unions, to be treated like adults. Security cameras and flowers dreaming the elevation of allegiance for Susie Timmons. From Walnut and Broad Street to Walnut and 19th, I stop for every security camera. Philadelphia watches us always. Fuck you watching us always. Several cameras in one block. I took notes. It was noon. It was 12, just as I wanted it to be. I took notes for the poem. Notes, notes, notes. A little basket of edible flowers. Nasturtiums, roses, pansies. I eat pansies. I love pansies. They're delicious, buttery purple lettuce. At each security camera, I paused, looked into the camera directly in there, and stuck my tongue inside a flower, flicked it in and out, flicking, licking, suckling blossoms. A security guard asked, "What the fuck are you doing?" I replied, "I'm a pollinator, I'm a pollinator." I allowed myself to say only this for the duration of the security camera pollination application. "I'm a pollinator, I'm a pollinator." I took many notes, and the notes became a poem titled, "I Want to Do Everything Wrong Just Once." And that's not necessarily true, but, you know, it is the title of the poem. I want to do everything wrong just once. Suddenly, we are a daisy under the big wheel. Throw it out to the batter. Leave it up to the outfield. The umpire sees how I divide you from me. You have no choice over the weak notes in the song. You think I'm afraid? Of course I am. I'm disgusted chopping us in two. Will it help to kill the one who hypnotizes you? We can try. We can always try. Betting on a better point of quaking. We cap the balding arm with angel wings, ancient astronauts. A poetic acuity we've been waiting to carry us away forever. To survive, I stayed away from people who wanted to kill me. That's the big secret. Let them jam it in the back of your mouth. Just a quick police search. So I want to read a couple of brand new rituals. This one is titled Denise Levertov versus Bruce Lee. And it's for Ray Armantrout, who is a student of Denise Levertov's. So I'll read the ritual first and then the poem. By the way, let me just pause for a second. The reason I do these rituals, I'll just be brief. I don't want to bore you with this, but the reason I do the rituals is because I grew up in a factory town and I wanted nothing to do with the factory. I saw how the factory, first of all, there's a bit of an introduction in the new book that talks about this, but an extension of that introduction would be to say that when I was maybe, I don't know, when I was a kid, I'm bad with remembering exact ages and dates, but my grandmother had a shelf in her living room of artwork by all 9 of her daughters and sons. And I was obsessed with this shelf, little paintings, pinch pots, you know, little pieces of artwork. But nothing after the age of 5. So I asked my grandmother when I was younger, well, where's the artwork they're making now? I mean, why is this stopping at 5? And she was very angry, and she said, They didn't have time for art. They're busy working. It's such an insult to her to be asking about this. And I was just like, oh my God, I got to get out of this place. And I did. I felt pretty good about the decision. I left. So, well, I have to say this. Originally, the factory that they were all working in was a coffin factory. So it was an old 19th century workshop factory, meaning that those old factories, you needed to have artistic skills. You needed to know how to work with wood and resin and fabric and metal. And my family members were very proud of these jobs because they were craftsmen and they were making these things. And when my aunts and uncles would get, and everybody worked there. The town grew around the factory and everybody in my family worked at that factory. So they also liked that. And there are photographs online of the Conrad family from the 1800s standing in front of the factory smoking. Anyway, so when they would get drunk at parties, they would show Polaroids of their latest coffins they were working on because they were very proud of these things. But anyway, with Bill Clinton's NAFTA, as you know, it destroyed the working classes, and then they had to start working in more modern factories. Unfortunately, my family, I don't want to get into this too much, but the Clinton era just really made my family Republicans, which is sad to say, because they associate the Clintons with NAFTA destroying everybody's livelihood. Mm-hmm. And they were correct. But anyway, so they started working in these more modern factories that, you know, metal punch machines, just these kind of deadening things, these things that just ruin people. My Aunt Arlene retired a year ago, and she died of alcohol poisoning 6 months ago. Like, they don't even know how to retire. So anyway, my point is I felt great about leaving. I was like, I have no interest in this world here. And I felt great about it. And I was writing. Writing was never a problem. But then 20 years later, in 2005, which is now 11 years ago, I guess, I went back to where I grew up for a family reunion. And I can't point to anything in particular that happened that spurred this, but on the train ride home, I realized, I had this epiphany that I had turned my writing praxis into a factory. And as soon as I got home, I threw the door open and I could see the desk. I could see it. The way I was writing, the way I was tabulating things. Anyway, I said I was doing a short version. I lied. So, sorry about that. So anyway, I didn't write for the better part of a month. And then I woke up one morning and said, I have to figure this out. And I started making this very long list about the problems with the factory, with sublists that manifolded back into the original spiritual deprivation sublists, etc. And then anyway, at the top of that list, I had written the phrase, the inability to be present. And I realized that that was a thing that terrified me the most, because my family's never really there when they're there, and they use the word hope all the time. And the word hope is not present. It's only in the future, obviously. And if you use that word too much, it means that your present is unendurable, and which is the case. I hate that word, hope. I'd rather we stay away from that word, because it's just fiction, right? It's just all like, well, we hope it's better someday, maybe. Anyway, so that's when I started doing these rituals. And the first, I started with colors. I started eating through the spectrum. Only red food, wearing a red wig, which is an odd thing to do, right? To go out in the public wearing this red wig. Well, and the best part about the wig was that it was a discard behind the beauty academy near where I lived. So it was like this red wig that was half permed and half straight. And it was stuck on a styrofoam head. I don't know, somebody flunked or something. Quit, maybe. That's the story. So anyway, so I started doing those. And then it just blossomed, and I found out that it worked. And that I was creating this place of extreme present. That's what I call it. Where while I'm doing these rituals, I can't be anywhere else. My mind just never falters from that space. It's changed my life completely. I'll just very briefly tell you, I had the good fortune of receiving a Lannan Foundation fellowship. And part of that is that you go down to Marfa, Texas. And I love this place. In fact, if I ever find out that I have a week left to live, I will probably race through every red light to get there and spend the last week there. It's so magnificent. But I spent a week there. I spent 2 months there. And I created 36 rituals to do every day for 36 days. And the labor of that was amazing. I was exhausted after the fourth day, like really, truly exhausted. But I just kept going and I kept, you know, drinking wheatgrass and stuff like that and eating brown rice. So that was a great experience. The thing that I have to say, though, about how it's changed my life, the rituals, I was leaving the post office and a car pulled up playing the song from the 70s, a pop song called Band of Gold. Doesn't matter. This is a pop song. And I had not heard the song since my childhood in the 70s, probably. And I stopped and I was listening to it and I was like, oh, that's what that instrument is. Maybe those are the lyrics, really? You know, just like in wonderment about this weird song. And then the song was over and I left. I went back to the house. And that evening when I was cooking dinner, I realized how significant that was. Because if I had heard that song a decade ago, I would have been hooked and dragged into nostalgia and thinking about, I didn't think about my childhood at all. I was really there for the song. So these daily rituals that I'm doing to write have completely, they've permeated every part of my being at this point. I love it. Denise Levertov versus Bruce Lee for Ray Armantrout. Denise Levertov is buried in Lakeview Cemetery in Seattle, Washington. For this somatic porch ritual, I would first walk through Volunteer Park, which is next to the cemetery, one of the most beautiful urban parks I've ever had the pleasure to visit. Crows are one of my favorite kinds of people on Earth, and there are thousands of them in Seattle, living like pigeons do in other cities, and several in Volunteer Park knew I would feed them and would follow me from tree to tree until I sat in the grass. In animal spirit lore, the crow represents finding our higher authority, choosing a more enlightened direction for our lives. After feeding the crows, I would take notes for the poem, then close my eyes to listen to the world around me for a little while. I would then walk into the cemetery, giving myself 27 minutes after passing through the gates to locate the poet Denise Levertov's headstone. If I did not find it, I would spend an hour in front of the grave where I stood. Bruce Lee is also buried at Lakeview, and his dedicated superfans would take the pilgrimage. Throughout the afternoon, young men whipped off their shirts to do martial arts moves in front of the headstone while their girlfriends made videos with their phones, those distinct sounds Bruce Lee made with his voice being imitated, echoing throughout the cemetery. I am certain I am not the only one to read a Denise Levertov poem aloud with Bruce Lee sound effects as the backup vocals. I would read, quote, "He himself must be the key now to the next door, the next terrors of freedom and joy," unquote. The best rituals are where the unexpected inserts itself. One day, while looking quietly for Levertov, there was a young man watching me. He was dressed in black with thick black eyeliner and fingernail polish. He wanted to know what I was doing, said he had been watching me. I asked why he was there, and he told me he liked to masturbate behind a shrub while watching the half-naked young men do karate. What shrub? I don't see a shrub. He took me to the shrub that was nowhere near Bruce Lee, but of course we could hear the super fans making their warrior cries. We had sex every day from that point on, and it became part of my ritual and part of my notes for the poem. When I found Levertov, he wanted us to ejaculate on her grave, but I vehemently forbade it, stating that we should only consecrate a gravesite if the poet would appreciate a shower of our semen like Jack Spicer, John Wieners, or some other faggot poet. I insisted that Levertov needed our tenderness, and we kissed instead and held hands while I read the poem The Broken Sandal, where she says, quote, "Where was I going I can't go to now unless hurting? Where am I standing if I am to stand still now?" Unquote. The notes became a poem titled, "Poem as Storm, Not as Refuge." home as storm, not as refuge. Where is the old druid who loved me when my tide slammed his door? Statue of Kafka, looking like Judy Garland, looking like me. Life is about choices, is what assholes with the best choices say. Take the Voyager crack beneath it. Riots on TV with commercials of cars, making men inside them clench their sphincters. It all happens with signals through mist. Cocks swinging to attention. Horny is not cynical, they promise. Glory keeping firm their soft road to genocide. A black spot of map. Capitalism and religion is no place to stand between. My song flushed from ear to page. The old druid loved it through his guitar. Furniture of future wastelands open to us. Wondering is like falling all over the mind. Kissing at edge of a landfill, no thought of death with his tongue in my mouth. No fear to fence in a sentence. We tear holes in the wall to watch plants grow. Love one another enough for the missing parts. Can you blame me? Became you can blame me. My cousin got me drunk to convince me to repent. Something his pastor taught him. I told his daughter, when you're ready to rebel against that bastard, here's my number. I will travel to you no matter where you are. So if you don't mind, I want to read another new one. This is, so currently I'm living in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm sure you're all well aware of the law, HB2, the bathroom law. And I have to be honest with you, I mean, I'm 50 years old, so I've been through a lot of bullshit. And when that law first came out, I thought, you know, this is just ridiculous. Right? Like, come on. And then I started going to the rallies, the street protests, and seeing the pain on these faces of these young people really made me angry. So I started taking it a lot more seriously, you know. I mean, it's obviously a serious problem. The lawmakers are out of their minds about this. If you've seen footage of them on the floor of the Capitol screaming about firing the district attorney because the district attorney is now refusing to enforce the law, but that's not his job. His job is to enforce the law. So they're firing him to replace him with somebody who will. Whatever. Anyway, I'm a firm believer that there's just a lot of nonsense about place. And I believe Asheville is one of those places at times. So this is a ritual called Power Sissy Intervention, number one, Queer Bubbles, for Candace Lynn. I occupied a busy street corner in Asheville, North Carolina, to bless children with bubbles that will make them queer. Not gay and lesbian, but queer. Bubbles, of course, do not have such powers. Bubbles have only the power to be bubbles. And some parents knew that and thought the whole thing was funny and would say, that's cool. I will love my children no matter what. I took notes for the poem. But most parents were not happy about queer bubbles at all. Ooh, bubbles. Look at the bubbles, sweetheart. Look at the pretty bubbles. I would blow bubbles for their tiny hands and say to the parents, these bubbles will assure that your child will grow up to be a healthy, happy, revolutionary queer who will help rid the world of homophobia, misogyny, racism, and other forms of stupidity. Parents pulled away nervously, saying, sorry, sorry. One mother abruptly yanked her blonde son's hand. Come on, honey, ice cream, ice cream. The boy cried, reaching for the bubbles as she refused to look in my direction, pulling him from the queering of the bubbles. Most parents, though, just said, sorry, I'm sorry, as they walked away. I took notes for the poem. The fear of queer will not dissolve with sorry. The apology is not acceptable, especially if their children grow up to be queer. Asheville purports to be a liberal, laid-back city, but queer bubbles pulled the veil aside for a closer look. One man said, Jesus loves you. I said, I don't think so. His face screwed up and he yelled, yes, he does. Jesus loves the queers. Isn't that nice? And his angry messenger roams the street to tell us so. We must insist that a redistribution of wealth always include the love. How can we be there for one another? How can we be assured that everyone gets love? Notes from the poem, Notes from the Ritual became a poem. The poem is titled, Every Feel Unfurl. I was naked on a mountaintop kissing someone who loved me. People fully clothed 2,000 feet below. As crossed out as this cage, I say, I belong to no more. The stars let me off the hook again. This is so new, I don't get it. Hear myself sing with a voice I do not recognize. The best voice to happen to me, I want it back each night. There is nothing little about little lights in the sky. Now the pronunciation is perfect for another morning of lips performing their duty to verb, shrouding ourselves by light of damage control stations of rhetoric. Lips as piglet prepared to be hacked apart beneath a greenery of mansions, a mess the ambulance cannot reach. There is nothing little about the cicada revving up while we think our car horns are so impressive. So I thought I'd end with just a few tiny little poems. And how's everybody doing? You mind me ending with the... So this is from the Marfa Poetry Machine. That's a very long ritual. I'm not going to read the ritual at all. But that ritual included such things as taking the film Giant, starring James... It was James Dean's last film. Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor. It was filmed in Marfa. So I took the film and I divided it by the length of the film by 36, and it came to 5.20 some seconds. So I watched it in 36 installments, about 5.5 minutes a day. It's an awful movie. I don't like it, at least. But anyway, it was nice watching just 5 minutes a day, though. And then, you know, things like paying tribute to deceased poets. I would get up every morning before the sun rose, and I would watch the sunrise on the Edgar Cayce Institute's webcam in Virginia Beach. And then when the sun started to rise in Texas, I would go out and see it. So I got to have two sunrises every morning. I like that.
You know, Creeley died in Marfa.
That's right. He was in Marfa. Actually, it was sort of like Midlands, right? Like, he was in Marfa, but then right. He started driving, and then right. He died in Midland. Yeah, I know. I was told that when I was down there. Eileen Miles owns a house down there now. I love that place so much. I can barely stand it. And, one of the things I did was I had a sweet potato that I decorated with a skirt, you know, eyes. And the local people, I hung out. I don't, you know, you can see artists galore down there, but I didn't really want to hang out with them. I wanted to hang out with the local people because the local people make the town, not the people flying in from New York to look at the art. Nothing against people flying in from New York to look at the art, but you know what I'm saying. I wanted to hang out with the people who live there. And they started to know me by the sweet potato. And they would say, do you have your sweet potato with you today? And I would say, well, yes, sir, I do. And I would pull her out of my bag. And that would be it. That would be one of the rituals. So there are 36 poems. I'm not going to read all of them, obviously. I'm just going to read a handful of them. I was very unhappy with the poems for a while. And then I realized that I was being too documentary poetics about it. So I was trying to talk about Marfa, but I don't know. I was already doing that in the ritual. So I chopped them all in half, and now I like them. And the architecture of them, I don't know if you can see from there, but they all just sort of laid out in their own special way. So there are four poems for each of the planets in our solar system. The ones for Earth, because my boyfriend who was murdered was named Earth, I call them home. So this is home point two. I love walking on flat surfaces. If mountains were flat, I would climb them all. A shot of gold in the seam, grafted from grown children of the gods. We are ordered to believe them, cock shoved into mellow afterthoughts. Clammy, groaning magic, turtle meat with a little hat and dress. Come see my little baby. Gather round my little baby. Pushing her carriage up the flat mountain down to the top. Mars point one. To be gone, a constant desire. Embarrassed for the giant leaning in for love. We had enough of the dance number, but the whirling begins, it just starts. Silos full of air, no more corn, no more wheat. Watching myself for full details in a strange man's pants. We let the soldier board the plane. Shot in head 3 days later. Why are you angry, you said. Why are you not, I said. Mars point two. To worship tininess of a martyr, observe shrinking church in rearview mirror. The black deer, it turns out, was beige, a tan doe covered in flies. Flesh of shame is nearly the shame of flesh. Pressing an unstable clock to cactus with one, two, three counts of recalibration. Fuck you who ask for forgiveness instead of permission. All clocks are precarious, inscrutable windows. Saturn point one. Butterfly in a tissue box. Not a real one, a painting. A monarch. One more sign for anguish, poured and poured. A choice to feel or stack bricks between. I was sad when my talented friend started designing television commercials. He told me to grow up. But the rocks in the desert I touch signal an endless new place. Something without money saying, never tire of demanding love for the world. Uranus point four. The only goal in my last life was to come back a poet. We had to leave, which meant backwards in the dance, check vital signs in the meadow, or maybe it was a rooftop. I don't know how I convinced them to let me do it. I used to think it was because I pleased them. Nothing mattered after climbing stairs to see you for the first time in centuries. Pluto point two. What's that? So the first line of this actually So while I was down there, I'm not here to gossip, but so I'm not going to say who or the name of the magazine. But an editor of a magazine wrote to me saying, hey, I really like your poems. Could you send poems? And I said, sure, here's some poems. And then they wrote back and said, do you have some happier poems? Because these are really depressing. And I wrote back and I said, fuck you. Don't ask me anymore. This is really insulting. Pluto point two. They requested a happier poem, the distinct sound of a backstab. Up in the stomach, getting a fix on the signal. Leave vomit on the seat and tell them we are not sorry for any of it. Poke surrounding haystack in search of a slow song. Excesses haunted by our poverty of benevolence. But we grab broader crotch of shoulder, corrupting smallest eyes in the freshly printed poem. Is the last one. Pluto point four. We win from time to time, abandoned above the adaptable positions of the losing. We risk everything in thinking we can navigate Maverick of the Green. Carry a bottle of wine into the pumpkin patch, looking for a new way to angle the old songs. Sell me a ticket to your dance, please. I believe in the strength of poetry. A little stone in the moth helps balance her on my breath. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks. So this is the ritual that I'm doing while I'm here. I'm using Olson's Maximus and Anne Waldman's Iovis, these two epics, as divination. So every morning I wake. So I have all these crystals on here, citrine and apothelite and amber. So what I do is each morning I ask the questions to the books, and then I open and close them 9 times, and they are really strange how they answer you. Beautiful things come up in both of these books, and I love the similarities that are in both of these books, because both Olson and Ann Waldman are, you know, they're firm believers in extraterrestrial visitations and Atlantis and like all these amazing magical things that come up. And then I go out and I try to find Olson's house. Amanda was helpful in giving me a first clue. So then I just like getting clues, you know. I'm almost there. I actually came here back in the 80s with 3 poets from Philadelphia, one of them who died of AIDS, and then the other 2 stopped writing, I'm sad to report, in all case. But we were very young, and we were very... we did acid, and it wasn't even my quest. I was there because I love my friends. But one of my friends was deeply obsessed with Olson. I was like, sure, let's do this. And we fell asleep in a car somewhere, and we were woken up to a police officer tapping the glass. And somebody said that he tapped the glass with his gun, but I think he was using his flashlight. Everybody's so dramatic, you know. And but anyway, that was my one attempt. We did find Olson's house, but, you know, I was a kid on acid, so. No acid now. I'm too old for any of that crap. So, but I'm excited to be here. It's an incredible place. I love this Writer Center. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Yay.
Thank you.
Did you work at the Coffin Factory at all?
No, but my father was constantly, he was constantly threatening me. So the thing is, my mother was in trouble with the law a lot, so she couldn't get work. So I would, she put me to work. So from age 8 to 16, I sold flowers along the side of the road. And there was nothing around. And this is the 70s, you know, so there were no electronic gadgets to distract me. So I became a reader. That's how I became a reader.
I can't resist reporting that I was exiled from Germany for drunken behavior at the age of 18. And I returned to the city of Nashua, New Hampshire, which is a working class community. And my job was working inside the Grand Estate Hardwood Coffin Company.
Wow, you worked in a coffin factory.
For 4 months, I was at the 3rd stage of lacquering. The coffin came right out of the oven, and my job, and there was a Lebanese and a Greek, there were 3 of us, to remove the tiniest bubbles from the finish before it got its last coat of wax. And I did that 10 hours a day, 5.5 days a week, for 4 months at the age of 18. And you'll love this, I think. What sustained me with that repetition and the heat of the oven was a constant hard-on and masturbatory fantasy. I would just dream it and dream it 10 hours a day. It was the only way to survive. It had none of this glory of craft or anything
right
with it. And the other guys sort of spoke the same language. It was always weird. We would arrange to take, can I take a bathroom break? And then they come back, and they were like an old Greek, 80 years old, and stuff like that. It was just the most, it was the first poem I ever published, too. It was in a journal called Zahir, which might have a mystical significance. And if anybody is old enough to remember a woman named Diane Krutchko, she edited these sort of hippie magazines in the late 60s. Very interesting woman.
Anyway. Maybe you made Kerouac's coffin.
Well, it's in Nashua, and his family is buried in Nashua. And I was out to this Buffalo conference now, and a truck went by, and on the side of it, Bakesville Hardwood Casket Company, which is the company that bought the Granite State Hardwood, which is a conglomerate hardwood coffin company, instead of the old one, you know, that was locally owned in the city. When I was a kid. I don't know, just because you told that story.
Well, the Boyertown Casket Factory, which was the name of the factory. Uh-huh. So there's a documentary that's just come out.
Bakesville has bought almost every independent. I follow this a little bit. coffin company in the United
States. In Mexico now.
Exactly.
Right. They've joined forces to make a super coffin factory that's supposedly the biggest in the world.
Well,
now.
The factory in Nashville still works, but this is a very intricate process. All these things,
The thing is, the coffin factory where I grew up is now an old folks' home, which is bizarre.
Yeah, I know.
So they're going backwards in time a little bit, you know. So you go there, and there are like all these people in wheelchairs chain smoking in front. Where they used to bring the coffins in and out. You know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, is the Book of Conrad going to be released?
I'm going to see it for the first time next month in Norway, because it's going to be, it's doing film festival circuits. So it was just in Greece and at the Documentary Film Festival. And so yeah, there's this documentary, The Book of Conrad. I didn't name it that. It's these two filmmakers from Delinquent Films. And they liked my books. They completely changed my life in a really great way, though, because if you see the trailer for the film, you can see my face. I look very shocked in the scene where I'm saying, and then he was murdered. Because I didn't believe that they were going to believe me, because the police have said, well, they've been saying that his death was a suicide, and I was just like, that's not possible. How are you even saying this? So anyway, yeah, we went down to Tennessee, the filmmakers, and the documentary is mostly about my books and my life, but this is the thread that they wanted to pursue, and I'm really grateful that they did, because I can't... The thing is, too, you have to understand, the FBI will not... And I, you know, like... The FBI will not investigate anything on your behalf. The district attorney has to invite them. So in 1998, when Earth was murdered, well, I'll tell you where all these people are now. That'll answer it. The sheriff is in prison for raping women in the jail. Three of his deputies went to prison. One of them killed himself to prevent from going to prison for shutting down meth labs and keeping the money. And the district attorney that I had to deal with back then was disbarred and fired for corruption. So every single person I had to deal with was just scum. And they really just didn't care. I mean, it was just like, they were brutal. Especially the sheriff, out of his mind. And the new sheriff is a lot nicer. He doesn't call me names. But he still has this cockamamie story like, well, you don't understand that your boyfriend tied his hands, he hog-tied himself, so that he couldn't turn back about what he was going to do. And I said, Sheriff Ray, his name is Sheriff Ray. I said, so Sheriff Ray, the filmmakers that I've been down here with just interviewed the paramedic, and they told us something that you, because he was a police officer during this. He wasn't the sheriff then, obviously. I said, you left out of the police report that his pants were down around his ankles. I guess you need to leave the rape out of the story if you're going to rule out a suicide, right? And then sheriff's tone, his tone changed a bit. He was very angry and demanded to know who the...
told you.
Yeah, and I said, well, it's too late. He's already signed off and it's on film. So what's going to happen is it's going to force somebody to do their job. Yeah. The problem, though, is, you know, Lambda Legal takes care of, you know, gay and lesbian violence in the South. They get over 200 some calls a day from violence, so, which is no surprise. It's a violent country. I mean, can I just tell you, do you mind if I tell you about the ritual that I'm doing right now across the country? There's a biennial report that the World Wildlife Fund publishes. The next one is due September of this year. So in September of 2014, the last installment of the Planet Index, which is basically the health of the planet. This is a consensus of different wildlife organizations, environmental groups, you name it, all kinds of different, very concerned groups. They've come to the conclusion definitively that 52% of all the wild animals on the planet have vanished in the past four decades. And that study, you keep in mind, is from 1970 to 2010. It's now 2016, so we're supposed to push it closer to 60. So as close to 60% of the wildlife has been obliterated. I'm looking at eco-poetics as not only the degraded soil, air, and water, but also vibrational absence. So when a species becomes extinct, they take their vibration with them. It sounds obvious, right? But to think about it along these terms, to think about who you are and when you were born. I was born January 1st, 1966. So when I was forming in my mother's belly, I was being formed, my cells were being formed, on this very rich organic vibration that was on the planet in real time. So children being born in 2016 have far less than half of that organic vibration. They're getting more of a mechanized, mechanical, metallic sound, human sounds. Also, Alex Renton from The Guardian newspaper in London published a study coincidentally the same month, September 2014, stating that we have crossed a line in the last few years where there are now more incarcerated animals than wild ones. He takes into account there are 60 billion animals farmed just for their flesh right now in samsara from birth to slaughter. 60 billion. That doesn't include the ones for their eggs, their dairy, you know, their milk, their wool, or the pets, or the zoos, etc., right? Yeah, that's crazy to find out that we are living currently in that zone that has crossed over. So what I'm doing is I'm thinking about, and I hate being depressed. It's the worst thing. I don't ever want to do it again. It happens sometimes, right? So what I'm doing is I've been gathering field recordings of all of these animals that have disappeared. And I lie on the ground wherever I go around the United States. I mean, you name it, everywhere. I've been all over the lower 48 states more than once, at least all of them in the last 3 years on this journey that I'm on. And I saturate my body with these sounds, starting at my feet. I fill and all the way up to my... I love when they get up to my ears, of course, because they're my ears. And the creepy news, is that I'm elated when it's finished, because I'm returning these sounds. I call it a returning. Like, my cells are drinking it in. They're, like, excited. Like, I'm, like, thrilled. I don't like that. I would prefer to be depressed, but I'm not. What does bum me out is when I'm doing the ongoing research. Like, for instance, the white rhino, which is technically, they're not white, they're gray. The word white, it isn't even white, is the German word for wide, and then it became white. I don't know. But anyway, they're gray. In 1970, there were 25,000 white rhinos, and now in 2016, there are three. There were four a few months ago, and now there are three. There's soon going to be none, of course. There's this beautiful little bird, this beautiful tiny little bird in Hawaii. Very long, I don't know how to pronounce the name of this bird, but beautiful crests and has this gorgeous little song. And there's video of this. You can see it online. It sings its song, and it tilts its little head to listen. And then it doesn't hear anything, so it starts singing again. It doesn't realize it's the last one. So that's the kind of thing, like, everywhere across the globe right now, they're, like, the last ones of so many things. And all of these ornithologists and other people who've been studying all kinds of reptiles and mammals had no idea. They thought they were doing research, but they really were creating an archive, a tomb. They didn't realize that they were making an archive of this extinction that we're in the middle of, that we can barely see. It's because we're too tiny, really, to see it. It's like hard to see these things, right? Like the poet Alice Notley has this line, poetry so common hardly anyone can find it. I feel like that's the same about so many things, right? Anyway, I've been doing this, and I sleep in my car in Walmart parking lots, because they allow that, mostly. And and what I do is I wake up, and then I go into the Walmart, and I listen to the recordings as well. They're around the perimeter of the store, and then I make a spiral into the middle of the Walmart, and then I kneel down, and I write notes. I'm now starting to do the lying on the ground in human trafficked areas instead of parks where it's safe. It's becoming more of an activist ritual, and it's not working out. You get thrown. I get tossed out. I did it inside of a Walmart in Michigan. I mean, I wasn't doing it where everybody's walking. I did it where nobody was at, where shampoo and greeting cards were meeting, you know. And I lasted about 15, 20 minutes, and then I was lifted up by these two people and thrown out. I started to talk to them, and they said, "We don't want to hear it. We don't care." And then they just threw me out. Walmart is, to me, the epitome of the results of manifest destiny. And I started on Whitman's doorstep, because Walt Whitman was a firm believer in manifest destiny. He was a firm believer in genocide. Whitman spoke very cheerfully about killing Native Americans and how black people were too stupid to vote for the president and they had the brains of monkeys. And it's very discouraging to hear a poet who we all have loved so much be so villainous. Anyway, so I start on his doorstep and go into the nation. And I believe that his love of manifest destiny results in Walmart. There are 9,000 Walmarts in the lower 48 states. There are as many as 500,000 items in each one. This is completely ridiculous, and we're at the end of this kind of era. Hopefully, this is all going to fall apart soon, because it can't continue. But it's there now, currently, and it's very strange. I use Walmart as a portal into this magical realm, right? The Walmarts are in different terrains each time. You're in Florida, you're in California, Montana. But when you walk into the Walmart, you go into that dimension. And the sounds are the same. The uniforms are the same. The same shit's for sale. You know. Walmart. Resurrect Extinct Vibration is the name of the main ritual. There were two of them, and they've merged into one now, because now I'm doing them simultaneously. The Walmarts, by the way, are it's horrifying at night, because the idea Sam Walton had was to get the baby boomers to park their Winnebagas as they're going across the country, and then they come in the morning and they shop, and now that's there. There are always these, you know, Winnebagas, but they didn't count on the fact that there are homeless people and entire families living in cars with signs in the window, "We need baby formula, we need diapers," whatever, you know. It's like every single Walmart has these families just completely destitute living in their cars together. It's horrifying. Anyway, I lived in a car for about half a year with my mother when I was a kid, so I kind of like have that in my blood. And I can have conversations with the people. That's part of it. But that's America. That's the real story. And so there are road notes. Plus, I've been a vegetarian for a very long time. And I'm always disgusted by the fact, you know, if a human being was hit by a car on the highway, somebody, they'd helicopter them to safety as soon as possible, right? But there are just, I just lost track of the number of animals. Every kind of animal. And so I've been making these crosses that I call roadkill crosses. And they're painted white. And then I have, like, dollar store plastic flowers on them. And I write, like, skunk. And I have the date. And I'll put it next to their body. Deer, you know, whatever.
Or is it, like, some small...
I don't even know anymore.
Yeah.
It just is always happening. I have a real knack for coming up with them. This summer will be my sixth year teaching at Naropa, the Jack Kerouac School. And one of those days we have to do one-on-ones with students. And it's so regimented. It's like you have 25 minutes. Like, student comes in, you have 25 minutes. And you have a five-minute break. And then there's just goes on like that. And I love it. And they always want to talk about their poems. And I'm like, all right, for 5 minutes. But then the rest, the 20 minutes, we're going to build a ritual just for you. And I'm really good at, like, coming up with them for some reason. And, well, this one student said, my parents are very angry that I'm here. They want me to go to business school or something like that. You know, I said, oh, okay. I said, so, because I asked them, I ask people, my first question is, well, the first day of class, I always say, 95% or higher of everybody I've ever met who's graduated from a writing program doesn't write anymore. It's extremely rare to meet somebody who still writes. Even if they haven't been to a writing program, it's extremely rare to meet people my age and older who still write. This world is just simply designed to destroy that part of us. So my job is to always get people in the workshops that I teach, conduct, to build that bridge in their brain back to the part that has that magic for them. So that's all I care about. And the first thing I ask when I'm building a ritual is, what is the worst thing going on right now? Because if I can get you to write inside that, you're free. And so this one student said, yeah, my mother, she calls me like a couple times a week and just yells at me. And I said, great. I mean, not great that you're going through that, but great. Here's what we'll do. Can you get a giant piece of white paper, like butcher paper, you know? She said, yes. I said, good. Tack it to your dorm door. Get some crayons. You have crayons. She got crayons. So you're going to make a haptic. And haptics are these like, it's like a seismograph of like a vibration of something going on. So while you're on the phone with your mother, you're going to hold the crayons like this, like a fistful of them, and just make this like pattern while you're on the phone without looking. And then you're going to sit across the room with binoculars and you're going to like study that and write your notes for the poem. You know, that's the kind of thing. There are times when I'm giving talk. Like, I've been teaching, I'm going to be back again this November in Southern Oregon. There's this amazing MFA that's on top of a volcano. And it's away from the mothership is in Portland, which is 3 hours away. So you're very isolated. The writing program is just like little cabins around this pristine lake with great blue herons and this kind of angry bald eagle that flies overhead and screams. And that's it. And you're writing, and it's great. The other faculty liked my teaching, and they wanted me to come down at the end of the week and speak to their donors, you know, the millionaires who fund the program. And I was like, wow, you know, like, that just sounds like a mistake. You're asking me to speak to these people. And they're like, no, you'll be great. I was like, all right, we'll see. And, and I did. And there was this one kind of irritated person sitting there with his arms folded. And at the Q&A, he just started talking immediately. And he's like, I don't have time to do this. I worked 80 hours last week. I run my family's tire factory. I have time to be writing poems. And I said, okay, well, do you have an office where you work? Of course I have an office. I said, well, do you have a closet in your office? Of course I have a closet. Do you wear ties? I'm wearing one now, aren't I? Like a very combative kind of thing, which I'm really good at dealing with for some reason. And I said, fine, here's what I want you to do. And I showed him a brain scan of people who've been playing violin all of their lives. It's this magnificent study. Yeah. You saw this? So people have been, they're now like in orchestras and they're like, they're...
Music changes your brain.
Well, there's this, they share this horseshoe-shaped configuration. It's on the surface of the brain. That is the first time in history that we've been able to see the manifestation of practice makes perfect. Like, that's what it is. This is this file that encapsulates all the movements. Then I was looking online, like, how to play the violin, because I don't know how to play the violin. And it's far more complicated than I had any idea. And I was like, oh, wow, no wonder the brain is so freaking tired and wants to build a file. Practice makes perfect just means that the brain, you're making the brain build a file so you can just go into it like that. I said, so whatever that is in your brain for tying ties, I said, I don't mean to be rude, but you look like you've been tying ties since you were born. And I said, so whatever that file is in your brain, you just do it. You don't even think about it. You've perfected it your own way. You probably gave it your own flair. Little fat on the top, skinny on the bottom, whatever you're doing, I don't know. And I said, what I want you to do is change your tie 3 times a day. You're going to write for 5 minutes as fast as you can. That's the trick to these notes. You're writing in front of that editor inside of you because you're trusting the ritual. You're not thinking about what you're doing. You're trusting the fact that you're already thinking, sometimes too much. That's what gets us to stop writing. And so you're going to write for 5 minutes before and 5 minutes after. And, you know, he wrote to me and he wrote a poem and we don't have a correspondence. He's busy. But, you know, I mean, like, he, you know, there's always a solution. And I believe very firmly that there are some very terrible things coming to all of us in this world. I mean, this is not like a prediction that nobody's already thought about. It's pretty clear what's coming. And it's the creative people who are going to make the difference. It's the people who are being creative in their lives that are going to have a wider idea. I told this man, I was like, look, I don't care what you do with your life, if you're running a factory, whatever. If you have a creative practice in your life, you're going to expand everything. Right? There's this school of thought called disequilibrium. It's the school of philosophy. Disequilibrium relies on the idea that we cannot have new ideas unless we create new ways of creating these ideas. So, I think it's similar. I was told by the poet Chris Martin that about this when he heard me read from the Somatics. And it is great. It's this great idea. I believe very strongly that that is correct. So all we have to do is find ways within ourselves to expand everything that we're, how we're thinking. And once we can do that, there's nothing that can stand in our way. I mean, there are so many people on this planet changing things right now. Like, I got to interview the grad students in Denver who won the Melinda and Bill Gates Award a couple years ago because they're designing a toilet that turns human solid waste into biochar, like that. Completely unheard of. Sounds like science fiction. Especially the American diet. It's super toxic. All the chemicals and shit we're eating, you know? I'm not sure whether it's more horrible coming out or going into us. And but the thing is, this toilet is going to suss out all these problems somehow and create that human solid waste so that it's readily used as fuel or fertilizer. I love that. Dr. Vandana Shiva is helping create these hand ones that turn kills pathogens in water sources. So, like, you just wave it over. And, like, there are these people coming up with these ideas that we need desperately, and that's happening. But we just have to keep encouraging everybody to be creative. And we have to demand that our public schools do not cut funding for the arts. They're probably more important than anything else they're learning. I have a real super soapbox for keeping people creative. I love it. It's important. Because every single human being is creative. And the reader of books, the readers are just as creative as the writers. So, like, you know, I learned that lesson very early, and I'm so grateful, because when I was a kid, I just overwrote my poems because I was like, I got to make sure they get what I mean because I'm such a fucking genius, you know? No. And what it all really is just wasting everybody's time, basically, because people are going to get the poem the way they're going to get it anyway. 1,000 people reading one poem make 1,000 new poems, right? It's all about interpretation. That's why I love poetry. There's so much room. And also, you know, I didn't mention this, but, like, I just had, you know, the Black Mountain poet John Wieners, the help of Jim Dunn and Garrett Lansing and a whole lot of other people. I co-edited this selected poems called Supplication that came out. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. A lot of work. I would do it all over again in a minute, though. I co-edited it with Joshua Beckman and Robbie Dewhurst. It was so beautiful. And he's like one of the most exciting poets of our lifetime. John Wieners. I just wanted to mention that book.
What is teaching a class, you know, reading through John Wieners? It's coming up soon.
Oh, great.
Yeah. She, part of her series that she does up in Toronto.
She has all Wawen?
Yeah, Wawen.
Oh, nice. She's probably using Supplication.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the next workshop she has coming up. Yeah, pretty cool.
I love Wa.
Yeah,
she did a whole thing on Nidecker's Lake Superior.
Yep. I took her class on Philip Whalen.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you like that?
Wonderful. Yes. It was very, very good.
Do you have her book, Red Juice?
I do, yeah.
Do you all know Wawen? Red Juice is such a great book. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Fabulous. Yay. Thanks.